Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 61. I'm recording it on Tuesday, December 16th, 2008. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is Don't Get Sad, Don't Get Angry, Get Smart. What prompted This is basically a podcast about investor education. And what prompted this is a thread that I saw at the Vanguard Diehards board at the Morningstar.com site. And it's called, I Feel No Pain for Madoff Victims. I don't know the background of this scandal. There's a scandal about a fellow who ran some sort of fund, and people have lost lots of money, and I know none of the details, and it's not something I intend to investigate because it just doesn't interest me very much. There's other people out there who are going to write about it and study it, and they can provide much better information on it than I can. But what I'm interested in is the reaction of investors to this, and that's my focus. I tend to focus on the emotional side of investing, which I think is the most important side of the investing project. And the emotional reactions concern me. They concern me. They're understandable, but they concern me. The first comment in this thread, the thread was put forward by a guy who advises people on the purchase of Vanguard funds. So he supports passive investing. And he says, the title is, I Feel No Pain for Madoff Victims. And he basically argues that, these people were trying to get rich quick. These people were bad. We shouldn't feel bad for them because, they're greedy. They're greedy. And then you get some comments coming back saying, no, I can't agree with you. There are a great deal of older folks that know little about investing and place total trust in what a so-called advisor offers. I'd say there were more saying that we should be sympathetic than there were saying we should not. Although there were some agreeing with the original poster. And somebody says, they're thinking they're smarter than everybody else. They're greedy, and so we shouldn't feel bad about them. And there's almost a self-righteous anger there. The idea is almost these people need to be punished, And that comes, I guess, what I want to say is that the title of this podcast is Don't Get Sad, Don't Get Angry, Get Smart. Well, most people that hear this story, the story is people invested with this fund, and they've lost massive amounts of money. Some people have lost their entire life savings. So getting sad is a perfectly understandable reaction to somebody who's lost their entire life savings. So I don't mean to say don't get sad at all. I what I really mean when I say don't get sad is don't let that be your response to this. Don't let that be your primary response to this development. If you want to feel sad for the people who were hurt, certainly, feel sad, offer up a prayer for them. But being sad in itself doesn't help anybody. If you're sad, more people are going to fall for this kind of thing, as time goes on, it doesn't help anybody. The other reaction, so sad is passive. It's not passive investing, but it's a passive emotion. And I think we have to go beyond sadness. We have to say, we first have to feel sad, which is an entirely appropriate emotion. But then we have to say, what can we do? How can we help these people? It's sort of like, you know, when there's a hurricane and it destroys, you know, towns or villages, and we all feel sad. All normal, healthy people feel sad. And there will be these relief efforts, you know, and they will ask people to contribute money, or people that live close by often will actually contribute their time. You know, they'll run in, they'll help people. And it's you know, it's, they always write this up in the newspapers, and it's a wonderful thing because it shows human beings at their absolute best when the chips are down. You know, we all can report incidents where, you know, you go to the grocery store and somebody cuts ahead of you in line, and you just say, you know, it makes you question your trust in your fellow human. You know, we all engage in poor behavior from time to time. Somebody engages how many times do people cut you off in their car, you know? And you're thinking, this person's going to get themselves killed, they're going to get me killed. You know, don't they have a brain? But then the chips are down, you know, it's a snowstorm, you know, the blood bank needs someone to give blood, and people are out there doing it. The reality is people have a dark side and people have a bright side. And the emotionally balanced approach is to understand that both things are always at work. So yes, you know, do feel sad, but don't leave it at that. You need to take action. You need to say, how can we, if we can't help these particular people get their money back, and it, you know, that may not be possible. I don't know the details, whether there are going to be lawsuits or, you know, whether the government's going to step in. I don't know. But if there's nothing we can do to help these particular people, there certainly are things we can do to educate ourselves and to educate others as to how to avoid this sort of situation. So don't let being sad be your only reaction. It's not enough. Now, what some do, and this I find offensive, is they get angry. They say, well, these people deserved it. And that's what you're hearing. Yeah, that's what the guy who started this thread was saying. And then there were a number who supported him. And I see that tone. I see that attitude on investing boards all the time. It all comes from dogmatism. The biggest enemy is dogmatism. And we need to ask ourselves, where does this come from? Why are there people who are, they're almost triumphant about it? They're almost, excuse me. If you read some of these posts, they're almost triumphant about it. There's almost an attitude of, oh, good. You know, they got what was coming to them. I'm so sick of these people making more money than me and bragging about it. And they've gotten caught. You know, their lives have been destroyed. You know, goody, goody. And I'm not exaggerating too much when I put it that way. There are people that appear almost that ugly in their comments. I'm sure they're not ugly people in their real life, you know, when you get them talking about something other than investing. But when they're talking about stock investing, this comes out, this ugliness. And I pay attention to this stuff. I believe it matters. Here's a comment like that. He says, all this meltdown is not about stupidity. It is about greed and risk. The higher the expected return, the greater the risk. Forget this basic and you'll eventually lose. And then he quotes from somebody that says, I've made many a few foolish mistakes in 50 years of investing, and it would have helped early on if someone had said, how could you be so stupid? And this guy comments, not stupid, just greedy. See, there's almost a joy in seeing people hurt. And I think we need to understand that if we want to be effective investors, we need to understand it's not a good thing to give in to these emotions, and it's not a good thing just to tisk tisk them, just to say, oh, you know, too bad, that's the way people are. We have to understand them. Why are people responding this way? As I say, it's dogmatism. What I believe is going on is investing by its nature is a frightening act. To invest your money means money is really a piece of your life. This is what I learned from Joe Dominguez. Money is really a piece of your life energy because you trade it hours of your life to get that money. So it's like a piece of you. And investing is putting that piece of you at risk. That's what investing means. If you don't have any risk, you don't have any return. There's got to be risk to get a return. There's always at least some risk. So you're putting a piece of yourself at risk. That is scary. You know, we used to play a game as children. I'm sure everyone's played this game where, I don't know what the name of it is, but you would, you would stand with your eyes closed, and your friend would stand behind you to catch you. And you were supposed to, you know, somebody would sort of push you, tilt you over, so you'd fall to the ground, but your friend is supposed to be there to catch you. And the question is, you know, do you have enough trust in this friend? You know, can you do it? You say you trust your friend. Do you really? Are you willing to fall and potentially hit the ground? Are you willing to trust your friend to catch you? That's what investing is like. What's going on is we're making a decision to put our money at risk, and we don't know if we're going to hit the ground or if our friend is going to catch us. And so what we're all doing is we're all trying to find the best friend. We're all saying, who can we trust? And of course, there are consequences that follow. None of us have perfect information. None of us. Warren Buffett doesn't know perfectly what investment is going to do well. You know, Warren Buffett himself will tell you that some of his picks end up losers. This is Warren Buffett. This is the king. So none of us know. We're taking an informed guess, but none of us know. And if we're always trying to persuade ourselves we did the right thing, once we take that guess, once we say, oh, you know, passively investing in stocks, that's going to be my friend that's going to catch me. Or, you know, buying gold, that's going to be my friend that's going to catch me. Or, you know, putting my money in a money market fund, that's going to be my friend. Or putting my money in tips, or putting my money in real estate, or putting my money in bonds, you know, whatever it is. Once we make that choice, we want to believe that we did the right thing. And so from that point forward, I call it being emotionally invested. From that point forward, we interpret all information to support the choice we made. We don't want to hear that we got it wrong. We don't want to hear that we chose the wrong friend, because that means our head's going to go crashing against the cement. We don't want that. So when information comes in indicating maybe we made a bad choice, we filter it. We say, no, that's not a problem. That's okay. My choice is a good one. My choice is a good one. Everything's fine. And human beings have, the title of the book I'm working on is called Investing for Humans. What I try to do in this book is, I think I'm the first person who's done this, look at investing how humans do it. All of the investing advice we read is hypothetical. People imagine these rational beings and they say, what would be the best way to invest if we were all purely rational beings? And it's nice to study that stuff. It can be helpful in some circumstances, but it's certainly not accurate because we're not rational beings. So what I try to do is I say, let's assume we were all humans. Let's try a different hypothetical. Let's just assume for 5 minutes that we were humans, that it were humans who bought stocks, not these mythical, rational beings. How would they do it? What would work if you were a human? That's the question. That's the theme of all the work I've done in this field. Let's just say for a minute that we don't want to know how investing works in this mythical universe. We want to know on planet Earth, how does it work? How would we do things differently if we discussed how it would work to invest as a human? And if you're a human, you're a rationalizer. Okay? We are the rationalizers. And so what happens is we get these data points coming in, and the data points say, you know, stocks are overvalued. You're going to get in trouble. You're going to lose all your money. And we say, ha, ha, ha. Stocks are not overvalued. Stocks for the long run. Buy and hold. Stay the course. Buy the dips. Timing doesn't work. Timing doesn't work. Timing doesn't work. We come up with these, you know, I don't know if we were, you know, if we were listening to witch doctors, what would they call it? You know, voodoo songs, you know? These incantations to the gods. And we say, well, if I just say timing doesn't work 500 times, it won't work, right? If I say it enough, and if everybody else says it, and if the experts say it, and if I sign it in blood, timing doesn't work. That'll mean timing won't work anymore, right? It'll mean I won't have to change my allocation when stocks get to insanely high levels, right? Won't that work? But it won't work, because it's never worked. There's never been a time when failing to time the market paid off in the long term. Never. Never. The historical data is public information. Anybody can read it. Go check it out, Robert Shuller's website, and you will find there is never in the history of the United States market, we have data back to 1870. There's never been a time, and it was a good idea to stick with the same stock allocation when prices went to insanely dangerous levels. And I'm willing to, you know, I'm willing to bet $5 there's never going to be a time when that's going to happen. And I don't bet $5 rashly. But we've come to believe it. There's no question whatsoever that millions of people believe this. There's just no question. And millions of smart people, millions of experts, people who have studied investing for years believe this. John Bogle believes this. You know, he's one of the most well-known investing experts ever. He believes this. So that's what's going on. And what's, you know, what these people are saying when they get angry is they're saying, you know, how dare, what the thought that's going behind the emotion, you know, this isn't what's said publicly, but let's probe a little bit. You know, what do we think the emotions are underneath the statements? The statements on the surface are harsh. They're cold. You know, they're unforgiving. They're ungenerous. They lack a generous spirit. We need to probe a little bit. Say, well, what's the emotion? The emotion underneath is, how dare they? Here I am investing in an index fund. You know, I'm aiming to get, you know, 6.5% real a year, something like that. And these people, they're getting, you know, 10% real a year, or whatever it is. I don't know what this fund delivered. You know, 20% a year. I don't know what it is. How dare they? And now they want me to feel sorry. You know, I've lost money. I've suffered 40% loss in the past 15 months. I'm supposed to feel sorry for these other people who've been, you know, raking it in? Let them suffer. Well, again, I said feeling sad was a perfectly understandable emotion. It's perfectly human, perfectly healthy, perfectly understandable. Feeling angry about people who invest in what appear to have been inappropriate ways, you know, that's also an appropriate emotion. Anger has a place in the world. You know, anger is not fashionable, but anger has a place in the world. I was on a blog the other day. The name of the blog is what's the name of the blog? Frugal Dad, I think it's called, Frugal Dad blog, and the guy had a blog entry. I thought it was great. It was about anger, and he said, you know, when I learned how to save, I had to become somewhat angry about wastefulness, because that helped me to think about things before I spent money. And I think he's exactly right. You don't want to become, you know, you don't want to give in to your anger. To, you know, you need to rein it in. You don't want to become an angry person. You don't want to walk around all day like a Grinch saying, you know, I'm not going to spend money, you know, waste the money, you know, kids nowadays, all that kind of thing. But you want to be, when you have a temptation to waste money, you want to be thinking, you know, maybe it's an advertisement, maybe it's a television commercial, puts the temptation in your head to spend money on something you don't really need. It doesn't hurt to feel a little bit angry, like, you know, I'm not going to let you trick me. I need that money. That's my financial freedom. I don't want to have to work, you know, when I'm when I'm 70 years old. So a little bit of anger can be helpful. And so a little bit of anger here is not totally inappropriate if you think people are investing in greedy ways. And I get the impression this fund offered huge returns. So let's say it was offering returns of 20% a year. I don't know. I just don't know the facts. But you get the feeling that they were offering very high returns, maybe higher than that. If they were offering these huge returns, probably there is a little bit of greed there. There is a little bit of a thought of, money for nothing. So maybe a little bit of righteous anger is appropriate. So again, I don't really want you to take the title of this podcast literally. It's good to feel some sadness. It's good to feel some anger. But as sadness, I said, isn't enough. Well, anger is certainly not enough. Anger won't get the job done. The problem with anger, the problem with sadness is it's too passive an emotion. It's inward. It's paralyzing. Sadness is paralyzing, I think. I think sadness is a good thing to feel, but it has to be transformed into something active in order to serve a good purpose. Anger is too outer directed. It's almost the opposite. It's, you're criticizing others, but how about taking a look at the man in the mirror? Get angry at yourself. And that's the message of this podcast. We all need to become a little bit sad about ourselves and a little bit angry at ourselves, because the reason we're feeling this anger at others, some of us, is that we're insecure ourselves. We know that we messed up. That 40% loss didn't just happen. We contributed to it. We all contributed to it, each and every one of us. Even those of us arguing for rational investing, we didn't work it hard enough. If we worked it hard enough, we wouldn't be in this mess we're in today. So all of us played a role. It's a community effort. You don't get the type of bull market we experienced in the 1990s without a community effort. There were a lot of bad decisions made. Millions of small, seemingly insignificant bad decisions contributed to make that bull market. And that bull market is, of course, the reason why we are suffering what we're suffering through today. The price crash, the passive investing price crash of 2008. And who knows for how long it's going to continue. So we need to look at the man in the mirror. We need to say, how did we contribute to this? An analogy that comes to mind, and I used this analogy once at the Motley Fool Board, and I think it's hard. It's a hard analogy to take, but I think it's accurate. It always bothered me. There's a phenomenon where women are raped, and you used to hear more about this in the old days, so to speak. But it still goes on. A woman is raped. And it's actually a standard defense lawyer trick. And people will blame the victim. Okay? They'll say, well, what was she wearing? That she got raped. What did she say to the guy? She talked to him? She smile at him? She laugh? Did she shake her hair? What's her background? How many boyfriends has she had? With defense lawyers, this is something done. Defense lawyers bring this stuff up. She was raped, huh? Well, how many boyfriends does she have? Understand what I'm saying. I find this offensive. You obviously need, you obviously need to prove whether the person was raped or not. You don't send somebody to jail if they didn't commit the crime. But I find it offensive that we put the victim on trial. The victim did not rape herself. Rape is a crime. Laughing isn't a crime. Shaking your hair isn't a crime. You know, wearing colorful clothes isn't a crime. All right. I think this goes on in the investing area. What people are trying to do is we're all feeling vulnerable. We've all been hurt, each and every one of us, some of us more than others, but we've all been hurt, and some of us have been hurt very badly. The ones that have lost jobs, or the ones whose businesses have failed, or the ones who have been kicked out of their houses. You know, painful, sharply painful things. And the way humans react to that is to ignore it. And I don't think we should ignore it. I think we should try to go back and learn from it so that it won't happen again. That's the constructive thing to do with all this pain, is to use it as a learning experience. And then we hear about a story of people who did worse than we did. You know, maybe we've lost 40% of our life savings, but they've lost everything. And we're not feeling real generous, some of us. We're not feeling real generous, spirited. And we say, yeah. I like hearing a story about somebody who got hurt worse than me. They caused it. They caused it. They're greedy. They caused it. They knew. Well, as I say, to a small extent, that's worth looking at. And you know, I think it's even worth looking at it in the context of the women who are raped. You know, in other words, I think it would be perfectly good advice to put in a magazine to say, you know, don't get too close to some guy you don't know. You know, if you're going to meet a guy for the first time, make it in a public place. You know, in other words, I don't see any badness, any harm in telling people to be cautious. And the same thing with investing. If the returns seem too good to be true, you should be a little suspicious. But it's an ugly side of human nature that we jump to this step where we say these people caused it. These people, you know. You know why most people invested in this fund where they lost all this money? There was probably some greed there. Greed is a reality of human nature. So there was some greed there. But the primary thing is they don't understand what they're doing. And that's something we all share. I have posted on discussion boards on a daily basis on investing for 7 years now, and I can tell you the state of knowledge of how stock investing works is primitive. We do not understand what we're doing, and we need to acknowledge that. We need to stop acting as if we know it all, and not most of us don't do that, but some very much do. Those are the ones that cause most of the trouble. But all of us, those of us who don't act like we know it all, and that is the majority, those of us who don't act like we know it all, we need to become a little more aggressive about getting answers to our questions. You know, we play a part in this because we need to get more aggressive in getting clear, understandable answers to our questions. You have a right to that. And if you ask a basic question, you know, I had a podcast and one of the basic ones some time ago. One of the most basic ones is when there's a price crash, where does all the money go? It's a wonderful question. And I've seen people ask it, and I say hallelujah anytime I hear that question. It's just so down to earth and so real and so practical and so right. And if an expert comes back with some foggy answer, most of us accept it. Most of us take it. And that's where we get into trouble. And we hurt not only ourselves when we do that. We hurt everybody. Because these questions need to be answered. We all need to learn. When you ask that question, it's not just you who benefits from the answer. All the people listening in benefit. So we need to get firmer about getting clear answers. And I have been on discussion boards with quote-unquote experts, and they can't answer these questions. Cannot. You know, I'll give you one example, Larry Swedrow. And I don't mean to pick on Larry. Larry said some great things. Larry's a guy, he used to post at Vanguard Diehards. He now posts at bogleheads.org. He's a financial planner. I don't know where he's based. He's written a number of books. One thing that Larry does, if I'm going to say something bad, I want to say something good. Larry has said, language as strong as you can say it. You know that I'm the person who started the new school of safe withdrawal rate research. The new school says valuations need to be taken into account. And, a lot of people have given me flack for that. That's an understatement. Larry said flat out, he says, the old school studies are a case of garbage in, garbage out. They're junk. Junk science. So Larry has done some good work. But, I recall there was an amazing thread where I was discussing with Larry what people should do back at the time, January of 2000. Stocks were the highest valuations they've ever been in history by far. Stocks were so overpriced that the expected 10-year return, the most likely 10-year return, was a negative number. People who were putting money into stocks were likely to lose money at the end of 10 years. There was a chance if they got really lucky, they would make a little bit. But there was a chance if they got unlucky, they'd be totally, destroyed. But the most likely scenario was a negative number after 10 years. And I said to Larry, how can you justify, how can anybody justify telling people to go with a high stock allocation in such circumstances? And he said, he gave this pat answer out of the books, the passive investing theory books. And he said, he agreed with me that the return was low. Larry agrees that valuations affect long-term returns. So he said, stocks were very overvalued. They were going to provide a poor long-term return. But he said, the return is always related with the risk. So if the return is really low, the risk must be really low. So, Larry was telling me in January of 2000 that was the safest time to buy stocks in the history of the market because the return was the lowest we've ever seen by far. He was saying that because the theory of passive investing says risk is always correlated with the return, that if the return was rock bottom, risk must be rock bottom. And I just said, Larry, this is crazy talk. That was the riskiest time ever to own stocks. How can you tell us the risk was low? And he said, that's patronizing, Rob. You're being patronizing. What I'm trying to say is I'm not trying to pick on Larry Swedrow. He's a good guy. He's a smart guy. He's trying to help people at this discussion board. He's offering comments for free. But he doesn't understand. Not because he's dumb. Because he buys into the passive investing model, which is the dominant model of today. And the model makes no sense. So it's our job, all of us working together, to press the Larry Swedrows, and I don't mean to pick on him, I'm talking about everybody, to press them to give better answers. And so we need to stop, when we see people getting burned, we need to stop blaming the victim and stop saying, they're stupid, they're greedy, but my investing approach is good, mine is smart, I'm not greedy. I don't know how much this fellow, who was at the center of the scandal, I don't know how much he lost for investors. I know it's a very large number. I don't know what the number is. But I'm certain that the number of dollars he lost is a tiny number compared to what's been lost by promotion of passive investing over the past 30 years. But, you know what the numbers are? Robert Shiller, recently, I saw an article by him, and he said the drop in stock prices, the real drop from January 2000, is now 60% in the S&P. So we've seen a 60% loss. It's a little over 40% over the past year, but 60% stretching back because the S&P was losing ground for 8 years before the price crash. It was, it was losing ground to inflation. So when you do an inflation-adjusted analysis, it comes to 60% total. So it's been 40% in the past year. So if you want to know how much it's been dating back to the market top, you've got to add about 50% to the loss over the past year. The loss over the past year was about $8 trillion, a little over $8 trillion. So the loss dating back to 2000 is roughly $12 trillion. The loss in the housing bubble, I believe, is roughly $4 trillion. I don't know exact numbers, but I saw somebody quote that number. And the housing bubble was just it was caused by the stock bubble. The stock bubble made people feel wealthy, and they poured money into housing, which caused a housing bubble. So if you add $4 trillion, if you add $4 trillion from the housing bubble, you've got a total loss from January 2000 forward of $16 trillion. That's the passive investing stock crash of the 2000s. $16 trillion. That's how much we've lost. So that's the scandal. You know, my annoyance with reading about this scandal, you know, seeing all the attention it gets, is not that we shouldn't look at the scandal. And if the guy genuinely did something wrong, you know, he should be punished for it. That's all fine. But the real scandal is what's legal, you know? The real scandal is millions of middle-class investors are investing their money, and they don't really know what they're doing, and it's not their fault. Because when we've had discussions of the realities of stock investing at our boards, we've had tremendous enthusiasm. I've never seen such reactions. There's no issue that middle-class people want to learn about more. I mean, they're not excited. I don't want to say that they're excited to learn about investing. Lots of us put it off. We don't really want to do it. But lots of us know underneath that it's wrong. Just like we sort of want to learn how to save, but we don't really do it. We want to learn how to invest more effectively. There's a pent-up demand there. But we need experts to help us. And right now, the experts are teaching us exactly the wrong lesson. Our common sense tells us prices must matter. It doesn't make any sense to think that prices don't matter, that stocks are always a good investment. And yet the experts are telling us that stocks always are a good investment. They're telling us, don't worry about price. Just keep that same allocation no matter what. They're drilling the wrong message into our heads. And we're paying to the tune of $16 trillion. Paying, you know, we're suffering. And we're not suffering alone. Our entire community is suffering. They call it a Ponzi scheme. The thing this guy set up, they call it a Ponzi scheme, his fund. And, you know, it makes me laugh. Not sardonically, but it just makes me, it makes me shake my head. Maybe that'd be a better way to put it. Robert Shiller is, in my view, the smartest investing expert alive today, author of Irrational Exuberance. Robert Shiller tells us in that book, and all the experts should know about it, it's a best-selling book. It's in all the public libraries. You can order it on Amazon. You pay a little extra, they'll give you next day delivery. Okay? They all know about this. It's been out for 9 years. It's not a new book. He's been doing research going back to 1981. Shiller tells us, page 67 of my copy, stock investing at times of high valuations is a Ponzi scheme. Did you know that? Is that not the bigger scandal here? This is Robert Shiller. When prices go up a number of times, investors are rewarded sequentially by price movements in these markets, just as they are in Ponzi schemes. The path of a naturally occurring Ponzi scheme, if we may call speculative bubbles that, will be more irregular and less dramatic since there is no direct manipulation. But the path may sometimes resemble that of a Ponzi scheme when it is supported by naturally occurring stories. The extension from Ponzi schemes to naturally occurring speculative bubbles appears so natural that one must conclude, if there is to be debate about speculative bubbles, that the burden of proof is on skeptics to provide evidence as to why Ponzi-like speculative bubbles cannot occur. In other words, they want to put the burden of proof on the rational investors to explain why stock investing at times of insane prices is a Ponzi scheme. The burden of proof should be the other way. Human nature tells us we turn things like this into Ponzi schemes all the time. That's why this fund, whatever it is this fellow had, became so popular. The people made tons of money on it, and then they told their friends, and their friends don't understand investing, because who among us does? What percentage of the population understands? So they said, yeah, why? Well, of course I'll invest in that. Why shouldn't I? And then they told more people, and those people told more people, and so on and so forth. And you've got a Ponzi scheme. Well, that's stock investing. That's the S&P 500. The ultimate Ponzi scheme. The biggest Ponzi scheme of them all. And I would like us to turn our attention to that. I would like to be talking about the giant Ponzi schemes, not these penny-ante Ponzi schemes that we're focusing all this media attention on. That, you know, if there's, again, if there's fraud, it certainly should be looked into. But I'm more worried about the millions and millions of us that are suffering. You know, many are going to suffer busted retirements. Many are going to have to delay their retirements. Many aren't going to be able to send their kids to college. So this is, you know, this is what we need to be dealing with. The gigantic Ponzi scheme. Not the, you know, not the little one. Not the little ones that pop up. They make for good press attention. But the big ones are the ones that matter. There's a guy I posted on this thread this morning at the Get Rich Slowly blog. And the guy, I don't know his full name, JD. I think he goes by JD. And he, you know, he's a big believer in stocks, as am I. He's a smart guy. He's got a fantastic blog. You know, he gets a million comments. And today, you know, he was a little bit passionate today. And he says, everybody's talking down stocks. And he says, I don't like, you know, he's annoyed by this. He says, I try to play it pretty even. But he says, I'm a little worked up about this. I'm going to defend stocks. And, you know, he presented a lot of evidence, you know, a lot of evidence that stocks are a good investment. Now, I think stocks are a good investment. If you've listened to other podcasts, you know, the rational model says stock investing is less risky than most people think it is. Less risky. Because with rational investing, what you do is you look at valuations to predict future returns. So you know when to lower your allocation so that you don't suffer wipeouts. That, of course, makes investing in stocks less risky. So I'm a huge believer in stock investing. I think I'm the biggest believer in stock investing there is. The people who pretend to be big believers are, you know, it's sort of phony, in my opinion, because they're telling us we've got to take on this risk of suffering a wipeout. And I'm saying, no, you don't. I'm saying if you just use common sense and you're guided by the historical data, you can protect yourself from a wipeout. So I'm a big stock guy. What struck me about this thread is the guy made this case. A good number of people agreed with him, more agreed with him than not. But there were a good number who didn't agree. You know, it was surprising given that, you know, if a guy puts forward he's obviously a big stock guy, and that's going to tend to attract other stock guys to the and gals to the site. So as a rule, you would expect that it would be a self-selecting group, and most people would agree with him. But given that factor, I'd say there were a good number who did not agree. What's going on is that people are losing faith in stocks. It's happening before our eyes. And, you know, it all could have been predicted. This is the way it happens every single time. Emotional extremes in one direction lead to emotional extremes in the other direction. So what we did during 30 years, we pumped people full of this passive investing nonsense. We told them prices don't matter, valuations don't matter, stocks for the long run, blah, blah, blah. Then they suffer a wipeout. And then they come to hate stocks. And both views are equally irrational. The healthy middle, the healthy emotional middle is you can't be blind. You got to keep your eyes open. And if prices go to the moon, you've got to lower your stock allocation to protect yourself. That's just common sense. So passive investing is out. But stock investing is wonderful. Stock investing is your ticket to financial freedom. And what I see happening is, now this guy has good arguments. The rationality is there. But what I see happening over time, it hasn't happened yet, but it's starting to happen. He's going to lose this argument. Because he's losing people. There are people who accept, there are people who loved what he said. But they're not as many as it would have been a year ago. And as time goes on, if this continues, and it will continue unless we address the emotional issue, the problems we face today are not economic, they're emotional. If he doesn't address this, not he, I mean, if as a community we don't address it, he's going to lose the argument. People don't make decisions by taking in data points and saying, oh, how logical, here's the logical response to that argument. People just don't work that way. He's presenting strong rational arguments. It doesn't matter. I believe me, I know. I've presented strong rational arguments for valuation-informed indexing for 7 years now. And I've had people, you know, slam the door in my face. More than once that happened. You'd be surprised. More than once. This guy, I could see this guy 5 years from now. 5 years from now, the worst scenario is we have a gradual increase in stock prices over 5 years. We get back to a P10 level of 21. And 5 years from now, we have another stock crash of 65%. We drop down to a P10 level of 7, which is where we usually end up in the aftermath of an out-of-control bull market. Another crash of 67%, and this guy's not going to be able to get anybody to buy into what he's saying. His pro-stock argument. Not because he's wrong, not because he's dumb, not because it's not a logical argument. Because people are going to tune it out. People suffer enough pain, and they're going to stop listening. And it all could be prevented. But in order to prevent it, people have to understand. It has to be a deep understanding. You see, deep understanding does not come by reading one rational argument. It just doesn't work that way. Deep understanding comes over time. People hear a message and then it's repeated, and then they toss it around in their heads, and their belief gets a little stronger, and they talk it over with their friends. And what we need is a national debate where we have a deep examination of the basics of stock investing. Does passive investing make sense, or is it true, as Robert Shiller says and many, many, many others, that valuations affect long-term returns? Because both things can't be true. If valuations affect long-term returns, it can't be true that long-term timing doesn't work. That doesn't make any sense. Valuations affect long-term returns. You obviously want to have a lower stock allocation when the risk of stocks is sky high than you do when the risk is moderate or low. If people understand that, and then that message is repeated over and over and over again, they will get to a time where they understand it on a deep level. And then we're in good shape. But we're not in good shape today, not by what I saw at that blog. Now, I wanted to read a couple of comments from Shiller, where he talks about how people learn. If I can find the right chapter. Yeah, investor learning. And I can only read a brief section, but he's talking about how people have learned that stocks are always best for the long term. And he says, it is clear that the possibility of major stock market declines does not worry most people very much anymore. But is this because people have acquired some genuinely new knowledge? Or are the new public opinions caused by something altogether different and ephemeral? He talks about, and then he says, a problem with this new learning theory is that the historical fact that investors have supposedly learned that the stock market has largely outperformed other investments is not a new revelation. And he talks about how people, quote unquote, learned this in the 1920s. But then, of course, they unlearned it in the 1930s. See, we learned because stocks perform in cycles. The last podcast number 60, was called Stock Cycles. Because stocks perform in cycles, of extraordinarily good, years and years of extraordinarily good performance, followed by years and years of horrible, bone-crushingly bad performance, because stocks perform in cycles, because they're bought by humans, and human psychology, you know, acts in cycles, because that's so, people, quote-unquote, learn things about stocks that are not true, and then unlearn those things. So, you know, we've had passive investing. We've learned that until it was no longer true. And now we'll unlearn it. And if we don't come up with some emotional balance, what's going to happen next is people are going to hate stocks, which is just as bad as passive investing. As far as I'm concerned, it's just the other side of the coin. It's two sides of the same coin. Two sides of the same emotionally charged coin. You know, he says, the fact that is widely cited is that in the United States, there has been no 30-year period over which bonds have outperformed stocks. And then he examines this. And, you know, he's got, he examines times when there have been price peaks, as there were in the late 1990s. And he says, in each of the 20-year periods following these peaks, the stock market has done badly in real inflation-corrected terms. The geometric average real return on the S&P Composite Index was a negative 0.2% from 1901 to 1921. 20 years of negative returns. It was 0.4%, a tiny, tiny, tiny return, far less than money markets. 0.4% a year from September 29 to September 1949. And 1.9% a year, still less than most money markets, from January 66 to January 1986, another 20-year period of poor returns. And surprise, surprise, each of these 20-year periods of poor returns are years following the time period in which the idea that valuations don't matter became wildly popular. There's a pattern here. So he says, so the fact of the superiority of stocks over bonds is not a fact at all. The public has not learned a fundamental truth. Instead, their attention has shifted away from some fundamental truths. And I think that's what's happened. We haven't learned how stock investing works. We need to go back and learn the basics. We need to go back and learn the basics. You know, people are trying to ascribe what's happening today. People are desperate to come up with some explanation. You know, this goes back to my rape analogy. Why are we so harsh in our judgments about women who are raped? You know, it's just ugly behavior. Where does that come from? You know, I don't think my fellow humans are ugly by nature. So where does that come from? It comes from fear. We're all thinking we do this with car accidents. You know, we all think, I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want that to happen to my, you know, my sister or my friend or my wife. So what we try to do is we come up with some explanation. You know, oh, she caused it, and that makes us feel safer. You know, if the woman who was raped caused it, well, then it's not going to happen to my sister or my friend or my wife. Because they won't cause it, you see. So they'll be okay. We're trying to tell ourselves stories to make ourselves feel better, more confident. We do this with car accidents. You know, somebody dies in a car accident, and one of the thoughts that comes to our head, admit it, is, did they do something to cause it? Were they drunk? Are they bad drivers? You know, were they not paying attention to the road? Now, of course, in some cases, that really did happen. And of course, it's helpful to know that. I'm not saying it's not relevant information. But what I'm saying is there's an ugly part of human psychology that wants there to be a reason why these things happened. And that's going on today with stocks. We've all suffered this price crash, and we're trying to come up with reasons. And people are saying, oh, it's because, you know, there's there's this fraud guy, this guy selling this fraudulent fund. And of course, there's the bankers, they're bad people. They're all bad. And there's this article in Fortune I hope to get to at the end of the podcast. You know, he blames SEC. The SEC's not doing its job. The government's not doing its job. We need more regulation. We need better enforcement of the old regulations. You know, we're looking for villains. We're looking for people to string up. Well, you know, there's a point, again, at which that's appropriate behavior. But there's a point at which our anger is self-defeating. We don't need explanations of this stock crash. The explanation is staring us in the face. Why don't we look to the people who told us it was going to happen? Robert Shiller wrote his book. It was published in March 2000. He wrote it before that, obviously. He told us this was coming. Shiller told us this was coming. How did he know? What made him so smart? I talked about a book in the last podcast, Stock Cycles. That fellow knew it was coming. The subtitle of his book was, you know, I don't remember exactly, but it was essentially why money markets are going to be a better investment than stocks over the next 20 years. How did the guy know that? How did the guy who wrote that know? You know, did he have a crystal ball? That's what they used to ask me. I would talk about how the retirement, the studies we all use to plan our retirements are analytically invalid. They all get the numbers wrong. And they'd say, Rob, where's your crystal ball? Where did you get your crystal ball? You don't need a crystal ball to know that if stocks are valued at three times fair value, they're going to be offering a poor return for many, many years to come. Do you need a crystal ball to know that? The dig that I was on that thread. The dig they make at the people who invested in this fraudulent fund, they say, oh, you know, they knew. They knew it was get rich quick. They knew that you can't get 20% returns. Well, how about the passive investors? Did they know? Where do all the passive investors think the 20% and 30% returns we saw in the late 90s, where did the money come from? Has anybody ever asked that question? Where did the money come from? We borrowed it from the future. That's why the future's looking so bleak. We borrowed those returns. That's why we've had bad returns for 9 years now. We borrowed and we borrowed and we borrowed and we borrowed. And not enough people spoke up about it. We caused this. And I'm not saying that to make you feel bad. I'm saying it to make you feel good. Because once you know why it happened, you see, you can get relief. You can get emotional relief. This is why I say, don't get sad. Don't get angry. Get smart. Once you know what caused this, you can stop all the nonsense. You can stop all the convoluted arguments about, you know, we've got, you know, the economy, we're never going to, you know, capitalism doesn't work, the U.S. is doomed, all this doom and gloom. It's not, there's nothing wrong with our economy in a very real sense. An economy is made up of, you know, machinery, buildings, equipment, people, education, skills. We've got all that. We've got everything we had 2 years ago, we have today. We could make this economy effective again, strong again. But the problem is, we had $16 trillion of phony baloney money that we were telling people they owned, and people started making bad decisions in every walk of life. And now we've had to take the $16 trillion away. And so naturally, we've got a problem. People can't pay their bills. I'm not trying to make light of the problem. I'm trying to point the way to solving it. The solution, Robert Shiller told us in an article a couple days ago, the problem here is psychological. The problem's not with the economy. If we tell people the truth about stock investing, we turn this around. It's going to take some time. But if you tell people the truth, they're going to develop confidence in the stock market again. Again, it's not going to happen overnight. It might take 5 years. But if we rebuild confidence in the stock market, we're going to be fine. So we need to stop attacking people. We need to stop just feeling sorry for ourselves. And we need to get smart. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was I just wanted to make some responses to. There's an article in Fortune about this Madoff Madoff investors burned by SEC, too. December 15th, Fortune. And he has some tips here, five tips for the investors. I'll try to go through them quickly. You know, he's saying how to avoid getting ripped off, basically. And his rule number one is, don't invest in something you don't understand. All right. You know, that's good advice. Don't invest in something you don't understand. How can anyone argue? The trouble is, the state of knowledge of investing today is so primitive, so poor, even among the best known experts, that none of us understand the market. I don't think that's much of an overstatement. I make this claim, you know, at my blog just this morning, I have an email that I sent to Michael Kitsis, and I say in the email, you know, Michael, I think it was about the podcast I did on him, and I changed the title because I say in the podcast, I don't consider him an expert. And Michael felt, you know, I was making a little dig at him. I said, Michael, by no stretch, you're wonderful. Michael has added all these emails that are just great. I said, Michael, you're one of the best. But I don't consider anybody an expert. Nothing personal. I don't consider anybody an expert today. Because we learn from talking things over with other people. And the state of knowledge today is so poor with this passive investing stuff, which is just crazy talk, that none of us are capable of having fruitful discussions. We've dumbed ourselves down. We've like taken our intelligence and sucked it out of ourselves. We've got to get back our common sense. Get back our common sense and it'll be fine. But telling people not to invest in something you don't understand, it's good advice by its standing on its own. But in the context, it sort of makes me laugh, because if we don't invest in things we don't understand, we won't invest at all. Because right now, we don't understand stocks, period. So we need to start talking. What I advocate is a national debate on how stock investing works. Then we will all be able to make better choices. His rule number two is, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Well, I just discussed that. Of course, that's true. You've got to be dangerous. When something looks too good to be true, it's probably not true. But guess what? The experts tell us to invest in index funds, in the S&P. Well, is that a free lunch? Where did those 20%, 30% returns come from that we saw in the 1990s? Aren't the passive investing enthusiasts telling us that that was a free lunch? If they tell us we don't have to lower our stock allocation after we get 30% returns, you know, or 20% for 5 years in a row, aren't they telling us there's a free lunch? If there's not a free lunch, we've got to pay for those returns in the future. So we should be lowering our allocation, right? So again, good advice, but in context, you know, it's missing a beat here. He's telling people, you know, to follow the conventional advice. And the conventional advice is every bit as guilty as the guy who ran this fund. If worse, in dollar terms, the amount this guy lost in the fund is tiny compared to what we've lost from passive investing. Three, he says diversify. Well, diversify is great. It's a great thing. But diversify is not the answer, because, you know, what I've seen on discussion boards is that people change their definition of what it means to diversify. Used to be that Bogle would say the S&P 500 is diversification. He said that's all you need. Because he said the U.S., these companies, they're invested globally. So if you're invested in a broad U.S. index, the S&P, you're covered. That's sufficient diversification. Now that the S&P has been a disaster for 9 years, go to one of these boards and they'll say, oh, that's not fair to look at how the S&P does. That's not diversification. They change the definition of it every time you turn around. So what's it mean to be diversified? Does diversification include TIPS? Does diversification include I-bonds? Does diversification include certificates of deposit? I say yes. I moved my money into TIPS when they were paying 3.5% real. I'm far ahead of the passive investors in the S&P. But that wasn't considered diversification when I did it. But I felt it was diversification because it was diversification across time. Because what I did was I said I won't participate in an insane bull market, but once prices come down, then I'll participate. So I had less stocks than most people when stocks offered a poor long-term value proposition, and I'll have more when stocks offer a good long-term value proposition, so that over the long run, I end up ahead. That's what works. That makes sense. And because it makes sense, I have confidence that a passive investor can never have. He says, don't stand for no or low disclosure. That's his fourth rule. That's a good rule. I'm a big believer in information. But again, a lot of the quote-unquote experts, they give part of the story. They give half-truths. And what we need to do is be tougher in demanding more of them. So they also fail to give adequate disclosure. You know, I had a podcast not too far back on called Bogle and Valuations. Listen to that one. Bogle's a great man. He's one of the great investing advisors of all time. But he's got big flaws in his ideas about investing. And I think it's a form of low disclosure not to talk about those. On the Bogleheads.org board, for example, we should be talking about them. We should be exploring them. We should go to Bogle himself when he appears at the annual meeting and say, you know, John Bogle, please explain. And that helps everybody because it helps us learn. It helps him learn where his weaknesses are. It helps everybody. And the fifth one is be wary of no-name operations. Well, there clearly is some risk. Whenever you're investing in something that's not well-known, you're never sure of who's behind it. So I sort of agree with that. But the name, there's no bigger name operation than the S&P 500, right? And the S&P 500 has been a total disaster for 9 years now. So, you know, going with a big name doesn't solve your troubles. What I believe you have to go with is, one, common sense. Any investing strategy that fails the common sense test, I wouldn't put my money in it, period. And this fund apparently failed the common sense test. So I agree that people should have been wary of it. But passive investing fails the common sense test. The idea that you don't need to change your stock allocations in response to dramatic price changes fails the common sense test. You know, end of sentence, end of paragraph, end of chapter, end of story. Fails the common sense test. And if you can't, if an investment fails the common sense test, you can never have true confidence in it. And if you don't have true confidence, you're going to panic during rough patches. And what we're seeing today is a lot of people starting to panic. So what I argue is, we're all reacting, we're all upset, we're all struggling to figure things out. We have natural human reactions to feeling sad, to feel sad about all this. And you know, it's appropriate, you know, cry a few tears, but you've got to get over it. Because feeling sad, you know, won't pay the electric bill when it's cold outside. We all have a reaction to be a little angry, and there's a place for anger, there's a place for righteous anger. But that also can be a trap. And, you know, it's sort of ugly on top of it. So we need to, instead of having anger at other people, instead of saying, hang these people up from a tree, these so-called bad people that caused all the trouble, instead of pointing the finger, look at the man in the mirror. You know, what have you done? What have you done to contribute to this price crash? Did you buy into passive investing? If you did, your hands are not clean. You're as much involved in the promotion of Ponzi schemes as anybody else. You know, if you bought the S&P and if you told your friends about buy and hold and stay the course and timing doesn't work and all this, all these half-truths, these marketing slogans. So third, don't be sad, don't be angry. Get smart. Getting smart means ask questions until you understand the basics. Spend your energies on the basics, please. Don't try to understand all the ins and outs of this fraudulent fund. This is why I won't even read an article about it. I'm just not going to waste my time because it's just a waste of energy. I could spend my energy on something more productive. I'm not going to invest in that fund. Now, if my best friend was in it, I might read about it. I'd feel sad for him, and I'd want to talk with him about it. But I wasn't in that fund, and my friends aren't in it, so I'm not going to waste my time. If the guy should be hung up, fine. Somebody will hang him up. And if the guy shouldn't be hung up, I hope he doesn't get hung up. But my attitude is, it's really not my business. I need to provide for myself and for my family. I need to learn the ABCs of stock investing. And that's what PassionSaving.com is all about, the ABCs. Learn the ABCs. There's an 80-20 rule that applies in investing. Learn the ABCs and you've got 80% of what counts in the long run. The 20%, I'm willing to, you know, I'll give it up. I'll give it up. I'm never going to be the best investor that ever lived. I'm never going to be Warren Buffett. But when I'm in a discussion board community and somebody gives an answer that doesn't make sense, you know, Larry Swedrow, his answer didn't make sense, or John Bogle, or, you know, John Graney, or Mel Lindauer, whoever it happens to be, I learned that I had to develop the courage to stand up and say, please, sir, please, that does not make sense to me. Can you please explain? I said, you know, you have to say it politely. That you must do. You know, if you don't say it politely, you become a goon yourself. But you have every right in the world to ask these questions. You not only have a right, you have a responsibility. We all need to do it. You know, my friend Petey Person said, you know, Rob used to be a puppy dog of a poster back at Motley Fool. What happened? What happened to our old Rob? Our old Rob saw people's lives being destroyed with phony baloney claims that valuations don't matter. And I care about my friends. I may not know much about investing, but I care about my friends that, you know, that I post with. They're my buds. That's how I feel about it. And so I worked up the courage. You know, this doesn't come natural to me. But it's what you need to get the job done. It takes a tough man to make a tender chicken. So don't get sad. Don't get angry. Get smart. Learn the basics of how stock investing works in the real world, and you'll be glad you did. It'll pay off big time down the road, and you can avoid all this pointless anxiety that we're seeing today. Pointless and even destructive anxiety. Get on, you know, get to a healthier place. My take. Good luck with your investing strategy.